Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 215, featuring Loic Zimmerman. Loic Zimmerman is an amazing creative person who I was first introduced to him by attending the conference that I'm sure many of you have heard me talk about called Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, or THU. So he was a speaker there. And he's also, besides being a concept guy, creative guy, he is a fabulous director. I really love his work, what he does. And he does some really interesting work, including some documentaries about the creative process. He did a really great one on Jeremy Mann, a painter, and it's really, really well done. And more recently, he is releasing, just released, and we mentioned it in the podcast towards the end, a documentary about this person named Larry. And that trailer is now out. So if you guys go to the podcast page, I will put the Larry trailer up on the page as well. So you guys can check out what that is and sort of get a little bit more into understanding what we're talking about in terms of that trailer. So really great to have Loic on, a very entertaining guy. And so definitely go check out the page after you guys listen to this podcast and see more of Loic's work. I will also put his director's reel up there because it's really, really great. Anyway, in terms of announcements, oh boy, I have a bunch of things going on. First thing is our products. Let's talk about the only thing I'm really going to mention is reiterate what I mentioned last week. V-Ray Cloud is out of beta. So guys, if you guys want to check out V-Ray Cloud and understand more about that, there is you guys can go right to our page, chaosgroup.com/cloud. And you will check out all of the offerings we have for cloud. It is a really, really, really simple solution for us to just basically go render to the cloud. What's the analogy we use? To show you how to use V-Ray Cloud, it's like showing someone how to make a photocopy. You walk up to the photocopy machine, you hit the button, you have a copy. That's pretty much how simple our cloud solution is. So go check it out, chaosgroup.com/cloud. Other announcements, there are plenty of events going on now, starting up. In fact, I will be at the Midwest University Conference in Minnesota on March 20th. I will be there as part of the keynote, which is kind of exciting. So if you guys are going to go to the Midwest University Conference in Minnesota, let me know. Give me a heads up. I'd love to say hi. And also, we will be, not me personally, because it's happening at the same time, there's going to be the GTC conference, which is the GPU technology conference hosted by NVIDIA in San Jose. Vlado and a bunch of our GPU guys will be there. So go check that out if you're into GPU technology, et cetera. That will be happening at the same time. And then finally, let's see. Total Chaos is the other thing that's happening. I want to make sure you guys know about that. We've mentioned it before, but Total Chaos 2019 is happening May 16th through 18th in Sofia, and there's going to be a great, great lineup of stuff. Just look that up, Total Chaos 2019, or go to chaosgroup.com/total-chaos, and you'll check out the amazing lineup of people that are going to be showing up. It's through the 16th through the 18th, as I said, but there's early bird special. So if you guys are planning on attending, go ahead and try to buy your tickets now. Early bird special ends on the 31st of March, and you'll be able to get 20% off your ticket to Total Chaos. So that's a really good deal. Go check that out. And then lastly, I guess the only other thing I should mention is that if you guys are enjoying this podcast and have heard some of the other podcasts that I've done with Dan Thrawn on CG Garage, we've gone ahead and spun off our own podcast called Martini Giant. So we'd love to, you know, let us know if you want to listen to that in addition to to CG Garage. Just go to martinigiant.com and check us out there. Or, you know, you can find us on pretty much anywhere that has podcast, iTunes, Google Play, podcasts, everywhere, Spotify. So just look up Martini Giant and you will see that we have an extra podcast there. Really exciting stuff. It's basically me and Dan Thrawn and Eric Sheely sitting around having a cocktail and talking about our favorite movies for about 3 hours. But it's a lot of fun. So definitely check it out. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that podcast as well. And that's all I have for now. So hopefully, with that being said, you will enjoy this fabulous podcast with Loic Zimmerman. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage. where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We've been talking for a little bit during dinner, but I think we need to recap a little bit for our audience that's listening to this. Tell me a little bit about your background in France and how that started your interest in creating things visually.
Oh, it started a long time ago. I think I'm lucky and doomed at the same time, but I knew what I wanted to do from early age.
Uh-huh.
I had that image of art school, you know, and I think it was a projection of my father's expectations, but it doesn't matter. It was the goal, you know, like I was 5 years old and I knew, okay, I want to draw. Well, I was drawing.
Right.
But, you know, I want to do something with that more than just like for fun. It has to become a job.
Right.
In my head, it was more like being a painter or something. And it changed.
More like being a what?
Painter.
Painter. Oh, right.
Painter,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like a fine artist.
Yeah. 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 That was, you know, I was surrounded by arts. My parents were very proletarian. I come from Champagne. My father was working in vines.
Oh,
you know,
right.
It was very, very simple rural life. I was living in a village with 40 people. I think there were two horses, one donkey, and a couple of goats as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so imagination was very early on, you know, the way out.
Right.
And I think I was 10 or 12 when I saw a commercial on TV, and it was for some berries, and it was a robot in 3D.
Wow.
And that robot was like, you know, I am this and that, and it kind of faded to death, and without berries, it couldn't work, and they would put the berries back in, and the robot was back to life. That blew my mind.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, that is what I want. And I think my father got it right away. But we were broke, so I didn't have a computer before age 16, and I ended up with one of those Amstrad. So, and I started pixel by pixel painting. Uh-huh. And just, you know, trying to do imagery. So at that time, I was really in between. I was building stuff in the backyard. I was starting into computer graphics, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word, and really hardcore into illustration.
Right.
So
that was the thing that inspired you in school, right?
Or? Yeah. No. Well, right away, as soon as you can narrow down your studies toward you know math or literature and a little bit of art, or so uh-huh. as soon as I could add and pile up on the artistic side, I would.
Right.
Which in France is when you're 15, 16.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had like 3-4 hours of art history per week. I had 3-4 hours of whatever, because it wasn't really practice.
Interesting.
But that kind of gave me the background, or the how could I say that, the education,
mm-hmm.
To then cruise through art school fairly easily.
Interesting.
Because we kind of did the same thing. I ended up with 8-9 hours of art history per week, which, you know, like everyone, I hated at the time, but I bless having those in my life. It fed me from richer influences than just comic books and films.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because I went through a French school system. I don't know if you,
oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah. I was as an American, I lived in Europe. I lived in Athens, and my parents decided to put me through the French school system, so through the lycée.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I went through the lycée, and I was doing that until I was 17.
Okay.
So, you know, I went through a seconde and, you know, all. You
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
Right at the, you know, troisième, you're like, kind of like, you take the BEPS, is what's called, right?
Yeah.
And so that's when they sort of decide, like, okay, where are you going to go? Are you going to go in this area? And
yes.
So they start to separate you in a mm-hmm. lot of interesting ways.
Yeah, fairly early on. Too
yeah.
early.
Too early, probably.
Too early.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, you're either going to go to Polytechnique and you're But that you're too young to.
I think so.
Yeah, you know.
I think so. I know people were terrified around me because they had no idea what to do.
Right.
So for me, it was kind of a poetic abstract idea of I want to be an artist, and you know the teachers would look at me.
And of course, when you at that, how old are you? I'm sorry if I can ask that.
When.
Well, how old are you now? Like around what age?
Oh, Jesus, I'm 44.
44. Okay, so you're not far from me. I'm 47.
Right? Yeah.
So at that time, like when you say I want to be an artist, that's in the French school system was not seen as a positive thing.
No,
that was seen as you're going to be poor.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, be my guest. Yeah, you know, do what you want, kid.
And that's a shame.
It is.
And it's an excellent education system. Honestly, mm-hmm. speaking, the French education it's at that time mm-hmm. was really good and powerful and really pushed some very concept ideas. But art was not revered as a track.
No.
Yeah.
No, you had a very traditional path that was called art appliqué. Mm-hmm. I know a few people who did that, and you would really learn the craft. Mm-hmm. And some of the most skilled people I know now went through that. Mm-hmm. And then you had the art plastique, which was the artsy-fartsy version of where you learn to be an artist,
right.
Which I did because it was cheaper.
It was cheaper.
So, right. Well, as in free, okay. You know, so good. Yeah, that cheap.
Yeah.
So at least my weak studies didn't, you know, grind me down and I didn't end up with a debt like most people here in the US.
Right, right.
The one thing I like about the American system, and that's really the only one, is the fact that a lot of people take a break. They take a breather in their 20s when they're done with whatever school you have before.
Right.
And they don't have to choose right away. A lot of them decide to travel, to work for a year or two and learn and be like, oh, shit, that's not fun.
Right.
You know? And it gives them that perspective and okay, well, you know what? I want to study that. And they get back into it. Where in France, it's a roller coaster. You have to keep going.
Yep.
So at 16, you have a decision to make. At 21, you have a decision to make. At 23. And those decisions, honestly, they lead you to be a teacher.
Right.
The French educational system is mainly to make you like sit your ass in university for the longest time, mm-hmm. and then you're overeducated for any given job, yep. or you become a teacher.
Yeah.
Which is fine if you really want to be a teacher, because that's a good thing to have.
Right.
But it definitely
there's
didn't.
There's only so many teachers that you need.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them just do it for what they had at the time, what was security of employment.
Right.
You're a government employee, so it's it comes with a couple of good things.
Sure.
Things have changed since, and it's a little harder.
Right, right, right.
And it's not like a good place to hide at all.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that's, you know, the situation. And I don't know if that's still the case in France. I'm not sure how their education system has evolved since I was in school. I do know exactly what you're talking about, because I know when I went when I left the school system right around La Seconde, mm-hmm. which is the equivalent of 10th grade here in the United States, and then I went to an American school system, and at which point they're like, oh, it's still way more broad. Like you still a lot more that you can study art, you can study history, physics, mathematics, you know, literature, whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
And then even so, when you go into college, you still have 2 years that you before you decide on a major.
Damn.
So you're almost 20 years old before you say, that's what I'm interested in.
Okay.
It gives you a lot more time, because in the French school system, you're like,
no, you're 16.
16.
You're 16. How much do you like, know?
I mean, you want to study economics now.
Yeah.
It's like, now well. I'm 16 years old. Like, yeah. It's a very
no, different. And the problem with that is that very quickly, well, it's probably the same everywhere, but you end up being eager to work. Like, okay, you know, that's boring. I just want to work.
Right.
And you don't get the value of what you can actually get from studying.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Depending on the job you have, your job is an endless study.
Yes.
And so is mine. And that's what I like
that's
about it.
That's what we love about our jobs, right.
And I would be very, very unhappy to have to stop that. But there was a moment where I wanted to get out of that thing, get my degree when I was in my second art school.
Right.
I just wanted to be done and over with and just do that full time and make money out of it and, you know, not have to. And I didn't realize that I was rushing it.
Right.
You know? But again, at least the money aspect is not too bad. The quality of the education is overall fairly high.
Right.
I know what changed the most now from, you know, back in the days is the fact that France kind of realigned with other European countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that the diploma I got is worth nada. You
okay.
know, it's like, yeah, okay, I've got a bac plus quatre, which is, you know, like a bachelor degree, mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Between bachelor and master's.
Right.
But yes and no. I mean, it's not really approved by any type of government or anything. It's funky. It's a piece of paper.
Right.
You know. So now what they have is actually something that works on a European scale and I think even world scale. Where,
good.
You know, you can go to another country and they recognize the diploma.
But okay, let's go back to degrees.
Yeah.
I know we're going on weird tangents, but that's mm-hmm. the whole nature of this. I have a master's of architecture, right?
Yeah.
I could have taken that and say, all right, I'm going to take this and go be an architect and do this and get my, my license as an architect
mm-hmm.
and then become an architect and deal with all that. But I decided to say, no, it doesn't matter. I want to do something else. And
mm-hmm.
I use that to become a visual effects artist, et cetera. And then in the world that you and I live in, well, your degree is way less valuable than your portfolio.
Yeah.
Your degree, you could have never graduated high school, and that's okay
mm-hmm.
as long as you had a good portfolio.
Funny enough, my degree only helped me to teach.
To teach, right.
You know, because yeah. I had a degree, I could teach in France, and I've been teaching here for a few years, and that was the one thing they would look at. Obviously, the experience,
sure,
but that little, you know, nugget
diploma.
Of paperwork and,
yeah.
and be like, all right, you're one of us.
Okay. It's very interesting that that's the case, you know,
yeah.
in a lot of interesting ways. Okay, so you went to France. You did.
Mm-hmm.
You went. You studied in art there. Luckily, you were able to do it for free, as you
mm-hmm.
said, right?
Yeah.
Where did you take that? What were some of the things that came out of that education for you?
I split it in two parts. So I went to an art school. I was 19, 20,
mm-hmm.
And it was really fine art. But fine art in a modern way. The school was kind of reinventing itself.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was oftentimes in my life, I arrived when the party was over. So when I arrived to that school,
uh-huh.
it was the last year of the one department that I wanted to be in, that one section that I was really attracted to, that was called Art Appliqué again,
mm-hmm.
where those guys were learning cartoon, illustration, photographs, like all the crafty stuff to be a graphic designer, to be an illustrator in animation and
sure.
all that. They were shutting that down and they were turning the school into a fine art, as mm-hmm. in really artsy-fartsy, and design.
Okay.
They did it because now the school has actually a decent reputation in design.
Okay.
I don't know what happened to them on the outside, but mm-hmm. always was a Russian roulette type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the first year I was there was a generic year where I had to do both.
Okay.
And the nerd in me was happy with design, product design.
Right.
You know, I kind of enjoyed that. I was like, oh, well, at least we are dealing with real tools. They started to tell us that maybe 3D would be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
They just needed a teacher that
mm-hmm.
wasn't there. And so there was this part,
mm-hmm.
More practical, more, you know, like you're making something tangible. And the art part, that was crazy. And that was very good for me because little country boy needed to be shaken up a little bit. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was really coming out of my cave
mm-hmm.
and being with all those weirdos and partying and doing crazy like performance and happenings and land art and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Welding iron sculpture type of thing, you know, like
oh, that's
just
awesome.
the whole stuff.
Yeah.
So it was abstract, it was not necessarily crafty, but the practice and the richness of that was amazing and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did 2 years in that school and I was really a little douchebag. So I was pretty much like good in everything,
mm-hmm.
good enough to go to the next year, but they were telling me like, yeah, it would be better if you go to another school instead.
Why
so they just
that?
Didn't warn me in the school because no, I was just an anarchist.
Right.
I was doing some weird stuff with my friends and just to a point of too much chaos.
Right.
And it was honestly they were right. It was just, you know, I was an asshole.
Right.
But I had fun and I occupied the computer graphics school, the room. They had a room with five or six Macintosh. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, this is where I'm going to live for the next year. Uh-huh. And there was no teacher. So one guy, very clever, told me, don't expect teachers to teach you anything here. Mm-hmm. Find the students, find the assistants. Mm-hmm. So what I understood was that the photo assistant who was now living in the lab, stuck as an assistant, was actually a teacher before.
Interesting.
But with the new reform, they, you know, he was too crafty. They push him away. And they say, now you're the assistant of that guy who was a painting teacher who became the photography teacher.
Okay.
And the video assistant used to teach video was now, you know, like just the guy pulling the cables together.
Right.
And I befriended those two guys.
Okay.
And I was spending all my lunch break in the photo lab learning how to do Argentic photo and just loving the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. And the rest of my time borrowing gears to that assistant and shooting weird films on the weekend, mm-hmm. editing on the U-Matic and HI8 and all those like obsolete format, and learning the craft, learning stuff that I really, really loved.
Right.
And on my own, I discovered Photoshop 1.5, right. I think, right before the layers. Mm-hmm. And that was like, I fell in love right away.
Right.
You know, and I saw that all those things were connected. So I started developing photos in the basement, running upstairs, scanning the photo. By the time it was scanned, it was already wiped away.
Right. Yeah,
there was no photograph anymore. And started to tweak in Photoshop and do graphic design and work in Quark Express and do fonts. And for me, it was just all of that at the same time.
Just
everything.
Wow.
So that experimenting phase was really brilliant. And then I moved to another school that was a bit more oriented into graphic design.
Okay.
Which is why I ended up graduating. Uh-huh. But same thing, I was still an anarchist. So on day one, I said, okay, I don't need your classes. I don't want to go through artistry again. You're going to teach me the exact same thing I've been doing for the past 5 years.
Right.
Some of the teachers really didn't know anything about computers and they started giving me feedback that was uneducated and I never enjoyed that in my life. Mm-hmm. I said, you know what, you'll see me at the end of the year. I'll come back with my project. So mm-hmm. at the end of the year, I came back with a project and they were like, all right, well, come back next year. We allocate a computer for you and you're actually going to be an assistant for the school taking care of the computers. Because
right.
I was pretty much one of the only students who knew how computers were working.
Right.
I was way nerdier back then, so I could build a PC from scratch and all that. So I was basically paid to work on my master's.
Right.
And I was deep into 3D at that point. I ignored the master's subject that was to do graphic design. I said, okay, graphic design will be part of my master's, but I'll come back with something more interesting. And I came back with a 2:30 animation in 3D. I had done all the audio mix, the sound design. And with that, I had a little booklet that I had designed in Quark Express. With, you know, instead of giving them like 100 pages that they would never read, mm-hmm. I did a little magazine, 10 pages with graphic design, beautiful images, very inspired by the work of David Carson,
uh-huh.
Reagan, and those publications.
Right.
So for me, it was a time where everything had to be, you know, put together. It was multimedia for real, mm-hmm. you know, but I was still doing practical stuff. I was still building sculptures in my living room. Mm-hmm. It was very creative, very fun, you know.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So how did this lead to your interest in filmmaking and get into that area?
Funny enough, I think I always liked film because when I remember as a child what I was doing in that countryside, I was building stuff. I was building environments. I remember making a spaceship out of, you know what a deux chevaux is?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so my parents had a very, very old deux chevaux and at some point that poor thing couldn't run anymore.
Sure.
And they had to cut it into pieces with a welding iron or something. Mm-hmm. And I had a pile of metal behind the house. And for me, it was heaven. My parents were terrified because it was sharp. Super dangerous and sharp. But I would be building spaceships and guns and stuff out of parts of the
deux chevaux.
And my imagination was flying on that. And I think I was already making films in my head like every kid would do.
Sure.
But then 3D became the extension of that.
Okay.
When I fell in love with 3D, I actually fell in love with a medium that would allow me to make those little worlds happen
mm-hmm.
inside my bedroom or my tiny little apartment back then. Right. I thought, okay, that's the tool I need now to make that happen, because honestly, the cameras we had, even in art school, they were way too expensive for my budget.
Right.
And the image was crap. Video right. cameras in, you know, we're talking like late 90s.
Yeah, they were terrible.
Were awful.
Yeah.
So then you had film, but film was extremely pricey. I couldn't.
And
so,
you had to develop it.
Yeah, the whole process was just not an option. And to be honest with you, I didn't even question it. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, that was just impossible. Film was like that thing that you just can't do it.
Right.
You know, and I didn't have the financial resources to go to a proper school somewhere to learn filmmaking.
Right.
So I kind of fell into 3D, both in love and in the trap or a spiral of it became an obsession for the following.
So was it just because it was the only way that you can get the look that you wanted, because it was not possible with video?
Yeah, because I could do everything.
Right.
Because I could build an object, because I could animate my cameras, I could actually animate those characters, so
right.
I could make something, I could make animation.
And
with,
the rendering was slow,
you know?
But you had plenty of time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My computer was running every night, and because I was in charge of the computers at school, I would be leaving last and using every computer they had to render my stuff.
Yep.
You know? And I have to say, when the people in school were very, very supportive. That drive that I had and probably still have.
Well, they're pretty happy that
they were happy.
They were using, you were using the computers they bought. No one else was doing
No, but I think people were scared. People didn't know where to start. They didn't really have the teachers to make that appealing, you know? And a lot of them were just terrified. It's that thing where, you know, who wants to talk in class? No one wants to talk in class. No one wants to raise his hand in class.
Yeah.
You know, people are scared, and because shame, because awkwardness. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them would be just scared of asking for help, or how do I switch on the computer?
Well, right.
You know, like they, nowadays computers are part of the environment.
Sure.
Not for very long, because they're being replaced by much more convenient devices, but
right.
The computer back then was just that weird box on the side, and people were just scared.
Oh yeah.
So having me there was reassuring, because I was one of them. I was sitting in the room all the time, so they would actually dare coming.
And you were a
peer too. And yeah, exactly.
You were not a teacher, so
no,
you're not intimidating.
I was just here working, doing my working on my degree, and they were like, "Hey, how do you scan an image? How do you print an image? How do you you know, open a file and save a file in Photoshop?"
Right.
And that's when the head of the school realized that I was actually doing the job of a teacher. So after my graduation, he offered me a job as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach pretty much everything I could teach for 2 years. That was Photoshop, Express, Premiere, 3ds Max, a little bit of, what was it at the time? AutoCAD or one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Just a bit more design friendly, but I was just good at giving them the basics of that.
Right.
And I didn't question what I was going to do. You know, it was like a cheap job. It was a minute 30 walk from where I was living.
Right.
So it was very convenient. I had like almost 4 months of vacation paid per year. So I was doing my personal projects all the time, and it was really a lot of fun.
And where was this in France?
It was in a small town called Troyes, which is next to Champagne. Like northeast of France. It's really minuscule. I mean, it's like smaller than Culver City.
Right.
But beautiful, medieval. You've got like five or six churches from the 1500, 1400.
Mm-hmm.
And the streets there look like Sleepy Hollow, you know?
Right, yeah.
It was old wooden houses and all like weird and funny and bright colors and just nice, but I would never go back. But it was fun.
It was perfect for you.
Yeah, it was. It was, because it gave me time. I needed time. I think, honestly, living in the woods, I joke about it, but I was living in the woods, you know, everything was overwhelming, you know, and funny enough, now I live in LA, but, and I'm more comfortable here than in the woods. I needed that. I needed those, it's almost like, how do you call it when you do diving, you know, and you have to stop when you go back up. to avoid like exploding.
Right.
I forgot the name of that, but
all the bends.
Yeah, you know, like every city for me was like a little step into something bigger, more people, more competition.
So
more...
it was that pause, so that you get acclimated as you go.
Yes, you know.
Got it.
So from the village to a small local town to this town to another town to living a little bit in other countries after.
You go from a town of 40 people in Champagne to. Yes. Los Angeles.
To Los Angeles.
So there were some stops along the way.
Yeah. No, I did a short. I lived almost a year in Italy near Milan. Mm-hmm. I worked in Luxembourg for a small while, and I worked in Paris for almost a year.
Okay.
Which I hated every single day of it.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, was it Paris that was the problem, or was the work that was the problem?
Both.
Really?
Both. Yeah, there was that you know, Paris without the Parisian would be beautiful. Right. I can
understand.
You know, the grumpy people in the subway. At first, the first month, I thought, okay, I'm gonna go through that. Uh-huh. You know, like they. It's your fault, you know. You look at them, you're like, oh my God, there's so much tension and anger in those people. Mm-hmm. And I thought it wouldn't affect me, but eventually it did. It started to really get into under my skin, mm-hmm. as like that layer, that thick layer of I don't know what, mm-hmm. you know, just grumpiness. Mm-hmm. And then the work was absolute hell. Part because I wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. So I got a gig I was a rendering supervisor and art director at the same time. It was kind of a hybrid.
That's a weird combo.
Yeah, that's a weird combo. Well, I really wanted to be, or I thought I wanted to be an art director back then, and they needed a rendering supervisor. And my experience.
But because you were so technical, you could manage it, right?
But yeah, so I thought, okay, well, that rendering thing is technical. I can do that. Mm-hmm. I've got the knowledge. I've learned enough things of the people I worked with. And I was fairly savvy into mental ray and those things back then. Mm-hmm. But my artistic background was telling me, like, you need to be an art director, you need to be the guy actually making the call.
Right.
But the thing is, at that time, I was not necessarily ready to embrace any type of IP you're working on that's not yours.
Right.
And that's the job, you know. So there was an ego thing in the way, my ego, and that didn't play well at all. So we had a lot of clash with the boss, mm-hmm. And we decided to part ways, and I went back to my little town. Mm-hmm. And I started freelancing, and just focusing on characters and character design and character modeling, texturing.
Right. So what led you to Los Angeles? How did that journey happen?
Funny enough, my tattoo.
Your tattoo?
My tattoo. Okay. Yeah. So I was working, so from one gig to another, I went back and forth, and it was really a lot of fun. It was the time where CG Talk started to become a thing, really. Yes. You know, you also had conceptart.org. Mm-hmm. So I understood that if I wanted to keep my independence, and I was, you know, I'm selling it now, but I had a fantastic house. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be there. You know, I was living the dream. I had like a factory, I had a massive loft and all that. So mm-hmm. I thought, okay, I want to work from home. I don't want to have any commute. I don't want to have any of that. So I need to have a voice out to get the job back in. Mm-hmm. So I started to post to show my weird work. It was like hybrid of 3D, 2D illustration. You know, I was just experimenting and working all the time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of made a name for myself, all things considered, mm-hmm. you know, in that little community.
Yeah.
My work started to get into exposé. I did one of their covers. And then Autodesk contacted me to do the splash screen for Motion Builder, then for Maya. So my work was actually traveling for me.
Right.
And people started to know who's that little weirdo there. Mm-hmm. And that got me the job at Quantic Dream to work on Heavy Rain.
Okay.
So they were looking for people coming from film or with an experience in film and high poly type of work because it was the beginning of next gen. And they realized that people working from traditional games, mm-hmm. they were kind of formatted for games.
Right.
You know, this is how you model a character. This is how you texture a character. Where coming from film, because I had worked on that feature in Italy, the constraints were very different. You know, you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of polygons. You've got very, very heavy textures and all that. And they were thinking, and their thinking process was very good. We want people from film to come work with us, and we'll make it fit into the pipeline.
Okay.
And Quantic was peaked at that time. Now they're opening up, apparently. I saw a post the other day from one of them on LinkedIn where they're no longer exclusively on PlayStation.
Okay.
But back then they were, meaning they were getting the best out of it.
Mm.
And that demo was very, very impressive. The first demo on Heavy Rain was like, what the hell? That's real time.
Mm-hmm.
So I met with them. I really befriended the supervisor, Thierry Prodhomme.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me the whole package. You know, like, this is how you work. This is the edge loop that we use for all the formation. Like, I had to learn a couple of things for game.
Sure.
You know, the way I lay out my UVs and I spent a few days in their office in Paris, and then they let me work from home.
Okay.
And, you know, we had a few guys. I forgot the name of the guy who was the lead modeler on that feature of the video game, Japanese Square Enix, Final Fantasy. You Final remember Fantasy. The first feature?
Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the modelers, I think he had an Italian name, but he was living in the U.S., was working for Quantic Dream at the time, and Steven Stahlberg was also one of them.
Yeah, of course.
So they had a few people like that, and I was one of them, mm-hmm. working remotely on the game as a senior concept artist, character artist.
Yeah.
So every month I would get a concept art and the photo shoot and the scan and everything. And I would come back 3 weeks later with a fully fleshed character for the game. And it was just a dream gig. To answer your question, how I got my job, I'm good at getting lost.
All right, we'll take the long story.
I thought, well, wait a second, you've got a scan. It was a medical scan. You could only do patches of body and recompile them. So that was part of my work. I thought, it's great. When we work on those characters, we work on all those like fragments of scanned information. We put them together. We retopologize. I do the UVs. I've got a character, right?
Right.
At the same time, I wanted a tattoo. And I thought, okay, I'm 32. If I don't get my tattoo before 33, I never talk about it again.
Okay.
It was kind of those deadlines. I had another one where I had to do my first LP at 27. I didn't, so I'm not doing music.
Okay.
I missed the call, you know.
You gave yourself a deadline.
Yeah, I do.
A deadline.
That's something I do for everything in my life, actually.
Right.
Without deadlines, you don't get anything done.
Right.
So I'm thinking, okay, I've got half a year to do that tattoo. I go visit a parlor. The guy is really good. He's a friend of a friend, and his work is sharp. And I wanted that. I didn't want like a chic, crappy blur tattoo. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I've been waiting for 10 years to design my tattoo at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at his wall, and I see a layout of a back piece, a Japanese piece, a tiger, just monumental piece. Mm-hmm. But I look at the layout, and I'm like, holy shit, it looks like a UV layout.
Yeah,
and I asked again. Right?
I can imagine, right.
I asked the guy, I'm like, how do you do that? He's like, well, you know, I trace a couple of lines on whatever limb or body part of the person, you know, and then I put the layout, a tracing paper on top. Mm-hmm. I cut to get better deformation, and my head, I mean, you can hear the gears. I'm like, that's UV layout, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And then he says it, I unfold it.
Right.
And then I design the tattoo, and I'm like, okay, I'm back in a month.
Mm-hmm.
I called Quantic and I said, do you mind if I swing by for a scan? And it's for myself. And Thierry says, of course, come by.
Mm-hmm.
We do the scan. I come back home and I start working on a digital double of myself.
Right.
And really,
you're unfolding yourself.
Yeah. So I unfold myself. I do the double, and I knew I wanted a sleeve, the full thing. I'm like, okay, if I just do one tattoo in my life, it needs to be a proper tattoo. So it's like one of those short sleeve, mm-hmm. chest, back. And I do the layout and I work, I experiment between what I want to do and UV transfer from one layout to another, you know, one that was tattoo friendly, one that was Maya friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that thing. And when I'm done designing a tattoo, I think, well, you've taken it so far. You won't be able to show anything from Heavy Rain before next year or 2 years from now. Why don't you do a digi double out of, you know, yourself?
Yourself, right.
So I started texturing and I worked my shaders in Mental Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And fur and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that online on CG Talk, and that fucking thing goes viral.
Right.
So people were just like, oh, that's awesome. I always wanted to do that, you know. But the thing is, when I post, I already started getting the ink done. So
right.
I gave the UV layer to my tattooer, and he printed it on tracing paper, and we put it on me, and we had like a 90% match.
Wow.
You know, so the tattooer was like, "You're just nuts." And we laughed, and it took
yeah, but it
40
him.
Hours to tattoo. So it's way longer and more painful than Photoshop.
Right.
You know, but that thing then becomes like that snowball effect online. It's CG Talk. It's all the forums. I end up on 3D Total and all those other publications,
sure.
all the way to Gizmodo and Wired.
Right.
And, one night, I'm about to go to bed, and I get that email from Luma Pictures in Venice, and Vince Cirelli, who was the head of CG there, mm-hmm. the supervisor, emails me saying, "Hey, seen your work, like the illustration and the 3D, because I was really doing illustration a lot as well. Mm-hmm. Looking for that type of profile, are you interested for a job in Venice Beach?" I'm thinking, oh, that's a joke, and I check their website, and I'm blown away. I'm like, holy moly, that's real.
Yeah.
Because I had job offers, you know,
sure.
but most of them are phony. You know,
was it really? I mean, is there a lot of phony job offers?
Yeah.
That get out? Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's always like people try. I mean, and they should, you know, like, "Hey, we're working on a video game. We need help for this and that."
Yeah.
It's always like starving
money.
Project. They have no money. And you're like, well, yeah, but, you know, the joke, you know, you don't pay your rent with exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was a real job. And I say, well, but, you know, and I was really happy with Quantic Dream. I knew I had another year of work for sure. And
sure.
honestly, I could have been working till now. You know, those guys were great.
Right.
And I thought, okay, do I leave that, the comfort? And I say, okay, don't think about it and accept the visit. So mm-hmm. they buy me a ticket to LA.
Wow.
And I fly there on Christmas,
mm-hmm.
2007. And I visit the studio. I'm just blown away. You know, I land in LA, so I hop in a cab, and it's a Collateral. You know, it's a Michael Mann movie for me. I'm like, holy moly, it's here as well. And I visit the studio, and I spend a week with them. I did a bit of work on a digital double. They try me out like right away. But, you know,
right.
So I worked on the, I forgot on what I worked actually, but it was fun. And I get the gig. I say, okay, I need to do it.
Okay.
You know, I need to do it. I'm 33. If I don't do it now, I will wake up one day realizing that I didn't live the life I could have lived.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I hate it, at least do it a year. You
right.
know? So we have a deal with the boss of the company. I say, well, if you're working on my old one, I give you a year. You know, I make mm-hmm. sure that even if it's like hell or whatever, we don't like each other. I work my ass off for 1 year. You know, and after 1 year, I thought, okay, well, you know what? It's I think I need another one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't see much of the town. I'm still not driving at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Not driving in LA. What a good idea.
And yeah, but you, when you're in Venice, like you can pretty much stay there.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was self-contained. You're in your little bubble.
Right.
But then
sure.
as soon as you want to do something, I mean, it's like $100 of cab.
Right.
There was no Uber.
Right.
But yeah, the first year leads to a second year. And the second year, I go back to France for Christmas. I hate it. It's cold. I get a pneumonia. And I'm thinking, you know what? I just want to stay in LA for now.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the weather, but I thought my life is going to be here. Like I need, there's more to be done.
Right.
So I get my license and I've been here for over 10 years now.
Right.
You know?
Awesome. But so you actually doing more than a 3D and concept art. You have a deep interest in filmmaking as well.
Yeah.
So where did that come from, obviously?
I think I always liked films, like, you know, it's like everyone. It's like saying I like breathing.
Right.
But I was watching films. I enjoyed them. But in my early 20s, I dated this girl who was an English major.
Mm-hmm.
She loved film.
Right.
And she was watching, you know, cinephile material, like authors. And she gave me the taste for movies in English because in France we dub everything. Like,
right.
you know, it's awful. So I got into that, into the cinematic language, and I started to realize that, you know, I came from painting, right? So painting, cinema, the visuals, the music, everything as a medium, I really loved it, but I just thought it was not an option for me. Like I just couldn't understand where to start, to be honest with you.
Right.
So I had done experimental videos. We had short films and all that, but none of them were really interesting. And then in 3D, I started doing tests, you know, like starting putting things together and, oh yeah, I'm going to do an animation of this, of that. But I would always get caught into the details.
Right.
Not block out, not do a layout or a cinematic or whatever. So at the end of the year, I would always end up with like 10 seconds of animation here, three there, like maybe 30 seconds of that. Not, all of that was useless.
Right.
And that's why I started to really push toward illustration. Illustration, every week I could deliver one. You know, I could make, and there was a...
There was a satisfaction in
Yeah.
There?
Yeah. Well, you know, finishing something is a good feeling. Mm-hmm. So illustration became my answer to that. But I was kind of, you know, blocking my own sight and not thinking about films anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think working in VFX and in VFX, you learn hatred. You know, you work on all those films, those weird deadlines, those stuff that you're never going to watch.
Sure.
And out of that hatred in me, I started thinking, but I need to do something. Right. You know, I have to get back on that. That's ridiculous. Like, if those guys get that done, you know, why am I not even trying? There's something weird.
Right.
But I think the real change, like for many, many people, was the day someone gave me a 5D Mark II.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so
it's funny you say that because that's a very similar story to David Levy, who's a good friend of mm-hmm. both of us, right? So David was saying it's like, you know,
exactly
I remember it wasn't the 5D to him because the 5D had already been out, but it was expensive.
Yeah.
But he on Tron had just gotten the 7D, which was the cheaper one, right? Yeah. And it's like, I can afford this. And then suddenly like, I need to make something right away.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
No, that was it for me.
Yeah.
I got that camera in hands and suddenly I realized, okay, well, A, I miss cameras. Like that was my favorite thing in art school. How come that right. 10 years later, I still don't have my own camera? I had like point and shoot and sure. all that, but... Get yourself a real camera.
Mm-hmm.
And within minutes, playing with that thing, all the Argentic training that I had came back. And I see that and I start making videos with it. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah, because it had a real lens.
Real lens, real sensor, real, nah, just the image. Yep. But the codec is awful.
It's so
but
awesome. That, I mean, I think, you know, that I mean, I hate to bring it down to technology, but that technology... inspired so many great creative people.
It was because prior to that, you didn't have the lenses.
Mm-hmm.
So you had those camcorders. And yes, the quality was better, but it always felt like family vacation
yep,
and film.
Because they had a big depth. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, the depth of field was just insane. And, right. and you want that shallow artsy
you
thing.
Want, yeah.
Right?
Or so, you want to be able to just do just low choose. Light.
Yeah, yeah. You know? No, exactly. And just there was something... somewhat cinematic about the yep. way that camera was capturing thing. But I thought, you know, and that's why my education, but I thought I didn't deserve it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a T3i,
mm-hmm.
which is even cheaper than the 70 from David.
Yeah.
But I thought, okay, you have to shoot with that thing every day, you know, to right. deserve better. And I shot every day. I shot hundreds and hundreds of photos. I was walking to work all the time and I fell in love with the medium, with the spontaneity of the medium. And I thought, okay, I'm going to work my kung fu. I'm going to frame, you know, get that back.
Right.
Obviously, I was working as a concept artist at that point. I had done the transition from 3D to concept at Luma.
Mm-hmm.
So framing, illustration, composition, all those years of art history mm-hmm. were coming back with that medium. But I needed the practice. I needed to breathe through the lens, not have to think about it, and eventually start filming.
Right.
So after 1 year of that, I think I did. Well, I got the 5D. After 1 year, I thought, okay, I deserve it.
Right.
And a friend of mine was selling his, so I got a good deal on that. I bought the 5D and I shot a black and white music video randomly, like a musician that I like.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to find someone online. Like I went on Model Mayhem. I found that dude with a really, really good face.
Mm-hmm.
A friend at work, Taylor, she was my muse, my model for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did that like chasing game in the streets of Santa Monica one night. I shot that, edited,
mm-hmm.
and put it out there and ended up meeting that musician. Mm-hmm. A few months later, thanks to THU actually,
mm-hmm.
And working with him. So that was the beginning of me making films.
Right. Well, that's amazing. That's great. And then obviously you got a bug for doing that, right?
Yeah.
Once you start shooting things and you start making films, you're like, I can't wait to make the next one.
I know it took over everything.
Yeah.
within, you know, I've been doing that now for I don't know. I mean, knowing that the seed was planted a long time ago, but as almost a daily practice, it's been 5-6 years where I'm pretty much doing only that.
Right.
And from the first one to the second to the third to my first documentary.
Right.
That really put things in place. You know, I thought, okay, I need something tangible. I think, you know, music videos are easy.
Okay.
They are. I think they really are. Unless you go for a power concept, very technical. Mm-hmm. You put anything on music, unless you're really terrible at cutting, it works.
Okay.
You know, it's harder to do a film without any music, and it's harder to make a narrative than to put eye candies together.
Sure, sure, sure.
That's my humble point of view, really, on that.
Okay.
But I thought, okay, I need something a little bit deeper than that, like a film, you know. And two people that I really like, one is Werner Herzog. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Roger Deakins. And both of them say, well, the best school for film is documentary.
Yep.
So I read that and I'm thinking, well, that's true. I mean, there's no rehearsal. You have to catch the moment. You have to build the story out of it.
You just have to capture a lot of footage.
You know, but you have to capture a lot of footage. But I thought, okay, that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to that art opening because there's a painter that I really liked at the time, and I still like him, William Ray. Mm-hmm. And I had seen the work of William through someone that you know, actually, Eric Schiele.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Oh, you know Eric?
Yeah, I know Eric. So I was hanging out with
him. You know, he does a podcast with me, too.
I did not know. Okay.
Yeah. So besides the CG Garage podcast,
yeah.
I do another podcast called Martini Giant. And he's one
no
of
way.
My and he's one of my co-hosts.
Oh. But Eric was, I met him at Luma and we befriended right away.
Yeah.
He had that crazy cuckoo-ness from the East Coast that I really liked.
He's very Northeastern.
Yes, he really is. And he's
and
got
he's
that
a
European
wonderful
vibe.
Character. And he knows so much about filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so Eric, I was doing my paintings at the time, that series called Tar.
Uh-huh.
Which is the vintage cars in LA, very orthogonal with a facade behind them.
Yep,
and,
yep.
You know, it was kind of, that was my portrait of LA.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at them one time and said, oh, it reminds me of William Ray. And he shows me a book and I look at William Ray and I was so depressed.
Like,
because William was doing what I was doing, but way better.
Yeah,
you know,
he was doing what you wanted to do.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was already there. And you're like, oh, well, okay, thanks for the surprise.
Yeah.
But I was blown away.
Yeah.
And he had a show a week or two after that.
Uh-huh.
So the timing was perfect because I was still like energized by that. I go to the show. I contact William before by Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And I had been to Salton Sea with a friend.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I did a painting of Salton Sea.
Yeah.
And William sees that on my Facebook and says, oh, it's funny, Salton Sea, I did paintings of that. And so we had like a first connection through the online.
We should describe Salton Sea because like
oh,
people from LA.
No, sorry, yeah.
I mean, it's a weird place.
It is a weird place. So if you go toward Joshua Tree, between Joshua Tree and Palm Spring.
Right, so in the desert of California,
it's the desert of California and something happened, I think it was in the 50s or 50s, 60s,
yep.
Right? Was it, what river lost its way? Or I think there was a flood or something.
Yep.
And a lake was basically came to life out of nothing.
Right. But
right?
It was somewhat manufactured, I believe.
Yeah. I forgot what was the reason for it. But
it was somewhat man-made, I think. I think so. But it's in the middle of the desert. So it's a very large lake in the middle of the desert.
It's huge.
Right.
That freaking thing is really huge. And
right.
Suddenly people, like realtor people in LA thought, okay, that's the new Palm Springs times 10.
Right.
We're going to build communities around that.
Lakefront
people
property.
Are going to, yeah. And they started to ramp up and create all that infrastructure. The problem is, I think they had an algae or something toxic in the water.
It's massively disgusting thing.
Right?
Right.
And everything died.
Yeah.
All the fish came to the surface. It stinks like hell when you go there.
Yeah.
And no one wanted to be there anymore because it's a recurring thing. It happens every year and it's just a plain disaster. So,
and it's gross.
It is really disgusting. The beach is covered by dead fish. I mean,
and it smells. And yeah. there's still people that live there, but not...
No, but that's crazy. You see a house here and then 20 around them are like burning because you've got all the meth labs.
Yeah.
and weirdos just like falling asleep and setting things on fire. So
right.
you are in a Mad Max type of environment.
Very much so. Yeah, that's a good description.
So yeah, when I went there, I was, you know, like everyone, I mean, they shoot music videos. They shoot,
yeah, because it's a very shoots. Weird place to live. Yeah. It's like it's surreal.
It really is. It's like it's very odd place. So for painting, it was great. And I did that painting. William did a painting of that. I go to his show and we just connect very quickly. Hey, Salton Sea. He's like, okay, you're the guy, Salton Sea.
Right.
And I ask him kind of awkwardly, like, hey, do you mind if I take your photo? He's like, oh, okay. And he starts to pose for the photo. I'm like, no, ignore me, do this, do that. And it's kind of, you know, he finds it strange. Mm-hmm. And I take the photo and I send him the photo that very same night. Mm-hmm. And he's like, holy shit, that's a good photo. Yeah. So I'm like, thank you, sir. I'm glad you like it. He's like, oh, no, I really like it. Do you mind if I use it? I'm like, well, yeah, but I would love that. Mm-hmm. And then he keeps going. He says, well, you know, but would be nice if maybe we can do like a little series of photo together, or I can give you a painting, or maybe you do a small film.
Right.
And I'm like, what? Ding. You know, and
that's your documentary.
And that's my documentary. And right. I'm like, well, let's do that. Let's do a short film about William Ray. Hooray. Mm-hmm. You know, so right. for those who don't know, William Ray, who's now in fine art, was an illustrator, and he did like a lot of background paintings for Ren and Stimpy.
Right.
A fucked up cartoon from the 90s or early 2000s, like crazy. And so here I am visiting William Ray once in a while and filming with him. And very quickly, I understand that it's not going to be a 5-minute documentary.
Right.
I need way more time than that. And I went on and off probably 10 or 15 times. Mm-hmm. And I disappeared. And William really think, okay, I'm never going to get anything out of that. And one day I call him and I say, okay, I sent you a link. There's a film for you, and it's 45 minutes long.
Right.
And it was my first documentary.
Right. Awesome.
And with that, I learned so much. I learned to, well, it's interesting. I had seen things with that break when you try to do a documentary about a painter. You know, you don't want to interrupt them. You want to be very discreet, all that. And I think my understanding of the medium helped me being a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. And the process was very, very smooth, and he really enjoyed that. And the narrative, the chapters, the building up a story, trying to keep the audience hooked. You know, it's a very raw and basic film that I did. Hopefully, I learned a few things since, but it was putting the foundations of my filmmaking. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to work on every little aspect, and I took that film with me, and I went to THU.
Yeah.
That year, and Andre offered me to open the festival with my film the first night.
Right.
Which
this
to me
is the
was
the first year, right?
So
2013.
It was the second year.
So 2014.
Yeah. 2014.
Yeah, that's when I went. That was the first time I went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I saw it. I remember seeing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Mind-blowing for me. I mean, I've got an audience. We've got that nice little theater, big screen, and people are just tripping. You know, he's a character.
Right.
So that's the beauty. If you have a good character, you can have a decent documentary.
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Know? And you know, people enjoy it. And there's this guy in the audience, Jeremy Mann. Mm-hmm. And I had met Jeremy at a workshop for Massive Black in LA. Same thing. I took his portrait. He's like, oh, I don't like my photo taken. I'm like, yeah, why don't you fuck off? And mm-hmm. I take the photo, and, you know, he used the photo on everything for a year.
Right.
So Jeremy knew me a little bit, and he sees the film, and Carla Ortiz mm-hmm. was here next to him, and she's like, Loic, you have to make a film about Jeremy. And I'm thinking, are you sure? Jeremy's going to let me make a film. Mm-hmm. And actually, Jeremy stops, and he's like, well, you know what? It's not a bad idea.
Right.
But I thought he was bluffing, and I called him a couple of months later, I think in December, and I said, hey, about that film thing, mm-hmm. you want to do it? And he's like, why not?
Yeah. And he's such a unique way of the way that he does creates things.
I knew, talking about subject, you know, where William had that education, and he's that voice, and he's very he loves to share, and he's, you know, it's great at getting you engaged with that thing. Mm-hmm. Jeremy is a dancer.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good way to describe
it. I've seen him painting, and it's just physical. The way he moves, you look at the painting and you're like, okay, that was done through, you know, body gesture and not just like mannerism. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, if I can do a film about that guy, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Like just him, you know, the fact that he moves so much in front of the painting, the process, the physicality of his work. Mm-hmm. I was really, really excited. And I tell him, can you send me photos of your house just so I get a sense of the space? You know, I can work ahead of time. And he sends me 5 or 6 pictures during the day and 5 at night. And I look at the pictures. I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah. I've been blessed. I've been to his house.
Yeah.
Because I went with I was in San Francisco, and then Andre and I were together. And then I drove
to Oakland
yeah. to see his house, and we had dinner there, and it was like,
it's great.
Oh, it's such an inviting place. It's a very Jerry May Mann space.
Yes. You know?
And then the house is an old house, very old house.
It's a Victorian house.
Victorian house, beautiful.
2 stories, very beautiful, a lot of textures. He redid everything.
Yeah.
And he's.
But
he's
everything is made there for you to reinvent yourself.
Yeah.
You know, there's tons of vintage clothes that you can just try on and do. Yeah. And then suddenly you put them on and you're like, I feel like I'm part of a Jeremy Mann painting.
Mm-hmm. I know, you rewind a presence. Century. You're back in 1910, 1920s,
right.
Which is his favorite time.
Right.
But for me, it was all textures and light.
Yeah.
You know, I look at this, I'm thinking, oh man, that's going to be great. The backdrop is going to be beautiful.
Yeah.
You know? So I rented a camera. I wanted to depart from the 5D at that point. I really hated the codec.
Right.
So the crappy H.264 or whatever.
It's
very compressed. You can't barely. I like grading. I like tweaking my shots.
I'm not
a naturalist by any means. So I needed that. I needed that, you know.
Higher dynamic range.
Yeah, higher dynamic range.
Mm-hmm.
I think Eric tells me about the FS7 or something. It was, so it's a Sony camera. It's a camcorder, but there's a hack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a decent HDMI output. And I rented an ODC recorder as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the ODC could record 4K in ProRes.
Yes.
So suddenly we're talking, you know, like I can put actual lenses. I put like, I used a speed booster. So I was pretty much with a full frame.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Super 35, that Sony. And I'm filming with that thing that I got 2 days before flying there. So I knew nothing about the camera. I'm like, holy shit, what am I going to do?
Right.
I was learning on the fly using my cat as a model, as always. And I just learned the basic, you know, how to record a clean ish signal,
mm-hmm.
and I fly there with my 2 suitcases, and I shoot the film in 3.5 days.
Okay.
So I asked Jeremy on the first, and it was awkward. We were not friends back then, you know, we're acquaintance.
Right.
And he was letting someone in his house, which when you know him is like a big deal,
mm-hmm.
and to film him working. So I knew I had to be as discreet as I could, and I said, listen, man, ignore me. Mm-hmm. But I mean, ignore me entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not here. You see me in the morning, you don't talk to me, you don't. We have no interaction.
Right.
And that was very odd. But I wanted that so I could capture the little bits aside from painting, because painting is fine, but you're not going to make a film with a dude painting for 40 minutes.
Yeah, you want.
I mean, you can, but it's boring as hell.
You may want video of him making breakfast.
Yeah, but it's like cuisine, you know, you want to be the fat, you want to be the, you know,
right.
smooth and the deal. So I had a paper, a pen, and I said, what do? You know, when you wake up, when you paint, when you take a break. So he's like, well, I do this, I do that, I feed my cat. And I had all the steps. And I said, well, I'll be here, I'll be out, you know, ignore me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And I was just filming him over and over, rotating around him, getting freakishly close, but mm-hmm. always stepping back quickly. And I was following the sun. So I was doing my coverage at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I would leave him paint for 5 minutes and go film in the kitchen and film in another room, film, mm-hmm. you know, the sun in the curtains, or mm-hmm. with all the textures in his house, the laces, the dresses.
Pretty amazing, you know? B-roll he can get.
Oh, yeah, my God. I had so much of it. And but some, you know, every film you learn. So I know that with William, I was falling short on B-roll.
Mm-hmm.
The editing was tough because of that. So with Jeremy, I thought, okay, a lot of B-roll, and especially with that location, you know, especially for documentary. So it was a lot of fun. I just filmed with him, and we had all those like cool little scenarios, the cat who licks his head in the morning and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, those are genuine moments. They're real. I knew about them, and I was waiting for it to happen, but you know.
Yep.
Midna, the cat, still does it. So it's it was about being real. Mm-hmm. You know, we never faked a scene, for example. Right. You know, I never like, yeah, I told him like, can you clean the brush? Was the extent of what I asked him to do. Like, oh, I didn't catch when you cleaned the brush. You know, like I need that because it's a shot, but we want to have. Mm-hmm. But anything else was just in the moment. And something really fun happened toward the end. We are filming and he's been working on that painting and it doesn't go well, mm-hmm. which for me is perfect.
Right.
Yeah. Because if it all goes well, you're watching a film, like, hey, I'm a good painter. Look, I've done a good painting. And you're like, oh, great.
The drama, right?
Right?
Yeah.
But I see that he's struggling on that painting and he's really angry. Like there's something wrong and I can tell. And I'm filming him and I feel the tension. And I cut. I look at him. I'm like, are you okay? He's like, no. Painting sucks. I'm like, wait, what's going on? He's like, I don't know. It swallows the paint. I don't like it. I want to throw it away. I'm like, oh, yeah? All right. Let's film. Mm-hmm. Because he was genuinely pissed off.
Right.
And so here I am. And I don't quite know that he's going to throw the painting away, but he looks at it, he steps back, and he grabs the painting and he puts it in the trash.
Right.
And he goes downstairs and he sits down, or not downstairs, upstairs, but he sits with the cat in one of the many rooms of the house, mm-hmm. and he's painting the cat, you know, and you get that moment of quiet, you know, like mm-hmm. he's just like breathing it out. Mm-hmm. Stands up, goes back in the room, opens Photoshop, picks another image, put the rulers, mm-hmm. print it, and it starts another painting. And I'm like, that's the film.
Right.
That is the energy. That is what it takes
yeah.
to be a painter.
Just get right back on that horse.
Get back on the horse.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was a very, very beautiful experience where all day long he would beautifully ignore me and arrive 7, would open a bottle of wine, sit down, I had a microphone, mm-hmm. and we would chat. And right. it was a dialogue. And all the voiceover of the film is through a dialogue.
Right.
You know, just so that we could turn that into a discussion between him and I and just bounce ideas. And that became the backbone of the film, really.
Right.
And it was an incredible experience. I spent half a year editing because, you know, full-time job. So mm-hmm. it takes a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, that film was a milestone in my filmmaking,
Well, it's great, and it's really cool that you were able to do that. And you know, based on those connections you had, obviously you made you found a connection that you did that allowed you to get into documentary film about art,
mm-hmm.
and then followed that up with the Jeremy Mann one, which came because you showed the first one. So it continues to evolve, right?
Yeah, no, then it created the dynamic, the momentum,
right.
you know, and then there was another THU, I shot the film at THU,
right.
that thing went on festivals, I actually yeah. won a couple of things here and there that got attention, I was right. really happy, and I put the film, after all that, I put the film on VOD,
mm-hmm.
on an extension of Vimeo called VHX back
okay.
then, and I thought, okay, well, you know, $5, and let's see if I can break even. You right. know, I had spent my money on that.
Sure.
I'm not counting the hours, but just like the rental and the equipment.
Sure.
I thought if I can break even, you know, I'm happy.
Right.
And, you know, I think I sold like something like 2,000 copies of the film.
Oh, nice.
So here
That's
I am
good.
With a bit of money and I'm like, I buy my camera.
Right.
You know, so I got my camera.
Nice.
And that was me now being free to film anytime.
Right.
You know, the thing is on the shelf at home and it's not like I have to rent something.
Right.
I can just anytime. You know, it's windy outside and I like the way the trees sway
yeah.
while I go and I film.
You're free. You don't have to
so I've got
think
that
about
freedom.
The rental. Yeah, that's awesome.
And after 1 year or a year and a half of VOD, I thought, okay, now let's put it on YouTube for free.
Okay.
20,000 views.
Nice.
Which, you know, it's a documentary about a painter. If I want a million
and
viewers.
And it's not short either. It's
no, 40. It's 40 minutes long, so it's commitment.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I can make a fitness videos and then we'll have more hits.
Right, sure. But that's amazing that you're doing that. That's great.
So
I think it's really great that people are able to do that and that you are able to make those connections. But it is a struggle and it's a commitment, right?
It is hard. I mean, yeah. So I was working full time at Luma at the time. Mm-hmm. So it's 45 hours a week. I didn't have too much overtime. Mm-hmm. I was putting another 30 on top.
Right.
Every week for 6 months.
Right.
You know, so after half a year, I was tired.
Yeah.
You know, but I couldn't stop. I was driving back home. I would eat and I would get back editing and grading and trying to figure out because I was learning on the fly. You know, I was just trying to make it work. I don't want to have a plan when I'm shooting a documentary.
Sure.
I want the story to unfold. I want to make sure it's real.
Right.
So I hope it conveys that. But every film that I've done so far, well, at least the documentaries, I'm finishing one now, are about that drive.
Right.
Because I love that. You know, those people to me, they're inspiring. When I teach, you see some students, you know, they ignite. Mm-hmm. And that response, that energy, I love that. I'm thinking that. I want to create that in people's brain and heart.
Sure.
And those films and those people I was lucky to work with, like William or like Jeremy, mm-hmm. and now Larry, mm-hmm. they inspire others. You look at their journey, you look at their commitment, their drive, their energy. I mean, that's amazing. And yeah, I could probably do the same with an engineer or, you know, there's so many fields on there, but I'm more prone to art. It's a subject that I like and I can bounce the conversation a bit more.
Right.
So it became my subject, obviously, but, you know, another film that I did was about a musician, you know, mm-hmm. and it's the same thing. Yeah. It's his drive.
Right.
The guy is playing, you know, at night in the middle of nowhere in a warehouse. I mean, you look at the place, it's fucking hell.
Right.
You've got trash cans in the staircase. You've got people on crack in the street. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even see that. He's playing a saxophone in the middle of the night and crying his lungs out, you know, and those are the people I want to hang out with.
Right.
You know,
I love it. It was when I was in architecture school, I could take a few electives when I went to Rice Architecture School. Mm-hmm. And I could take a few electives that were outside of the architecture class. And I had just a couple that I could do because you obviously have to, you're doing your master's in architecture. You have to concentrate on your actual courses you do for the class. But I took a documentary film class.
Oh.
And I loved it. And I happened to have met this random guy, who was in a, you know, lived in a trailer park in Texas. I lived in, you know, this is in Houston. So it was in a trailer uh-huh. park just in the suburbs of Texas. And I got to meet this guy and he was a weird character, but very charismatic.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, I have to make a documentary about someone. Can I do it about you? And he's like, fuck yeah, man, whatever. You know, like he was that kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, all right, let's do this. And so I just grabbed, you know, this is when we still recorded on a VHS tape, like literally big camera
okay.
on VHS tape.
Nice.
And so it was a big camcorder you had to carry around. But I went up to his house. And I said, and he knew I was going to come over, and he said, and I drove up, and he says, well, yeah, sorry I didn't call you, but, you know, I kind of had an accident at work, and I don't know if we can do this documentary. And I said, well, what happened? He goes, well, you know, he worked at a chemical plant, and Ooh. Some molten salt hit his arm, and he had third-degree burns on his arm.
Oh, man.
And I was like, oh, shit. And so I said, we're starting a documentary right now. We're going to talk about that.
That goes to your subject.
And so suddenly he started talking and I turned and I just all this footage I got of him and he was so kind of cool about the whole situation. It was kind of surreal. It was very weirdly Texan situation. And I filmed a ton of stuff of him, like him and his arm, him talking to lawyers about like trying to get workers' compensation. It was this weird stuff that like, I can't believe I have a camera right now. This is amazing.
Whoa.
And I just filmed and filmed and filmed and filmed. And And then I like I, he did a birthday party for his kids, but he's you know, he hates his wife, so it was like the second birthday party, and like it was a whole Texas thing going on in a trailer park, very surreal. And and so I met this you know, my teacher, and I'm just sort of trying to relate to the thing about editing. I had to make like a 10-minute, 20-minute documentary at most.
Yeah,
and you had to present to the class, right? and I had like 20 hours of footage. Right? I had a ton of footage. I had tapes stacked up. And I didn't know what to do with this, you know, like a lot of content. And I had my teacher, and I was sitting there on a Saturday, and this is back before nonlinear editing, where you have to like to place the tape, cut.
In, out.
Yeah. And I sat there with my teacher, who was this English English guy,
mm-hmm.
and he was you're not supposed to smoke in the classroom, but he smoked in the classroom, and so he had his leather vest, and he was like, "What's going on?" And it was on a Saturday, and I said, "I've got all this footage. I know there's gold in here. I don't know what the story is. Like, I don't know how to turn this into a story." And he sat there and he watched like 2-3 hours of footage with me. And then he's like, "All right, we're constructing the story. Here's your story." And he's like, "This is going to be good. You're going to do this." And I wrote it down, and I finally, you know, I was up all night, you know, for the whole weekend, to like, didn't sleep, put this thing together. And I was like, "Oh, it's so rewarding."
Oh yeah.
It's so rewarding, especially when it's real. You know what I mean? It's just like you described, the minute you started describing him throwing the painting away, you're like, "I can't believe I have this on film."
You know? No, you have moments where honestly you hear your inner voice.
Yeah.
You're like, "Whoa, now.
Yeah, like, I know.
Be aware of now, because. Yeah.
There was, I'll just to describe one moment I had when he was told me about his arm, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, he says, he was a typical Texas guy. And he says, like, "Well, let's go out and get a beer. We're going to go to the bar. But before we go, I got to go shower. So I got to take care of my arm before we do that." And I said, "Okay." And so he says, and so he starts undoing the bandage. And, you know, you see a big bandage and someone tells you he has third-degree burns on his arms, you know it's not going to be good.
No.
But I said, "I'm going to turn the camera on. I'm going to film this, right?" And so he's sitting there.
I'm in pain.
So he's sitting there, and the moment is amazing because he's in his trailer, and he's describing what's happening and how he needs to care for his arm because of what the nurse told him. It's like, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that. And while he's doing that, and he's got a very thick Texas accent, which actually adds to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has an aquarium, right, that's big lit, so there's blue light coming out. So it's creating this blue light on his face. But there's no fish in the aquarium. He just likes it because it's because of the light.
Soothing.
So it's got this blue light on one side and this orange light from the kitchen on the other side.
All right.
And he's playing, there's very soothing country music coming from the radio, but you can hear that it's from the radio, so it's kind of background.
Mm-hmm.
And as this is happening, he's undoing his thing. I'm like, "I can't believe I got this on film. This is going to be amazing." And he's describing, he's like, "So yeah, you got to put this cellophane on top of that just because it keeps it sterile and the bandages would stick." So he's taking off the cellophane and going through this whole thing. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I have this." And it's those moments, right? And that you invigorate you, that are so cool. Yeah.
I felt like I completely relate to what you're sharing here. I felt the same even with still photographs.
Oh yeah. Yep.
You're working. I do a lot of street photographs.
Yeah.
And you see it happening. There's a moment. Someone, a ray of light, a little something happening, but just it's the framing, it's the proximity, it's the contrast, it's whatever. You've got 2 or 3 factors coming together.
Mm-hmm.
To manufacture that is very hard.
Yeah. You just happen to be a witness.
Are you here? You got the camera? And that's been a game for me of anticipation, of just like looking, hunting for those. The one thing I was telling my students at Nomon oftentimes was a camera helps you appreciate things around you.
Yes.
Reconnect with the world. Because to go back to what we said about Paris and the subway, you know, I hated the subway. Well, maybe now we take photos in the subway.
Yeah.
Although I would probably have problems. But you end up shutting yourself off of the world. You don't want to be part of it. You ignore it. It's commute. So commute is wasted time. Mm-hmm. Well, when I started taking photos again, commute was not a wasted time.
Right.
It was about hunting for even a freaking flower in an empty field. I would take a photo of that because it's the only flower. You know, it's as simple as that. A beautiful car, a beautiful person.
It makes you realize all the things you miss if you don't look.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, it's all around. And that's how I actually discovered the inner weird beauty of LA.
Yeah.
You know, by
I love LA.
LA's got an interesting light.
But it's only for people who look for it, I think.
You have to look. It's not a city that gives itself as easily as San Francisco.
Right.
You know?
Or you can't go like LA and just walk around Crenshaw.
You know, very underwhelming.
You're like, it's
all
not
right.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No, you have cities that are in your face and others that require a little bit more hunting.
Yeah.
But those moments, those like a documentary is good for that.
Yeah.
I had an angle. So that's what helped me. I didn't have 20 hours or I don't know how many on. I think for William, I had more rush because I had no clue what I was doing.
Right.
So I was filming. I thought, okay, absorb, try to get good shots.
Right.
Work your point of view. Think about the cut, like how you go from that shot to that shot. And I was really working the language, the mechanic.
Right.
With Jeremy, I had learned a few things in the meantime. I had struggled on my cut with William.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew what to look for, but I knew the title of the film.
Okay.
So I knew I wanted to call it Solitary Man.
Mm-hmm.
It was an easy play with the word, but it was to show that, to show isolation, to show that guy who stays inside. And when you know Jeremy, that's one facet of the guy.
Right.
He's very open. He's got friends. He goes out. He's traveling.
Mm-hmm.
But the film, I had to have an angle. And I said, no, I want to show that part. I want to show commitment because I'm sick and tired of like, oh, yeah, all this. You hear that artist or you guys or now you have no idea the degree of commitment that it takes.
Right.
I compare that to scientists, to doctors, doctors like researchers, you know, they disappear. They dive to a point of, you know, do I have enough oxygen to come back? No, it doesn't matter.
Right.
They keep diving, you know,
because
maybe there's oxygen down there.
Yep.
And I love that. That's commitment. So with Jeremy, I thought, okay, Solitary Man, I want to show that. So it helped me narrow down. And honestly, I had maybe 5 or 6 hours of footage.
Mm-hmm.
So for 45 minutes, I actually shot fairly efficiently on that one.
I kind of knew. That is very efficient.
Yeah. I was lucky because, a few scenes were a little wonky, but I eventually got rid of them. I had enough.
Right.
Otherwise, documentary, you can end up. I mean, I met a guy in my building and he said like, oh, yeah, there's a guy, he's an actor. And he's been like, 30 years of acting.
Mm-hmm.
He's making a documentary on himself, meaning like every time he can catch someone and have them film, he's got 300 hours of footage.
Yeah, what is he
gonna do? He tells me like, oh yeah, you want to cut a film? I'm like, no fucking way. Are you kidding
300
me?
300 hours, yeah.
That's insane. That's ridiculous. We're not making Apocalypse Now here.
Right.
So no. And I'm finishing one now and I shot a lot more, but I'm still fairly... Like I had an angle again.
Right.
When I started the film, I knew about my subject. I had done my homeworks. And I thought, okay, well, I want to approach it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not forcing the narrative. I had no clue of the actual structure of the film.
Right.
I had an idea of that's what the story is, you know?
Right.
This is the journey of that man. So now how do I film that?
Mm-hmm.
And you capture those moments.
Mm-hmm.
You create those situations or not. So it's part of... He's a filmmaker and a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
What's the process? What's your history? Couple of locations, you know, and trying to find the visual language that will fit the character. And then, make sure that you have enough material, that you have that flexibility when you cut the film. So I had a lot more on that one. I could have probably done a film that, longer. Mm-hmm. This one is another 45 minutes. I like it because that's the max you can do for a short when you do film festivals.
Right, okay.
You know, otherwise you end up with the features, and yes, I would like to say I've got a feature.
Right.
But it's also a feature done for $5,000. So you, right. you fight with you know, studios and all that. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, 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 of course.
I don't want to be in that pool. But same thing, every time you get to be more than that fly on the wall, they open the door, and like this new one, I mean, I went many times. So it creates an intimacy with the subject, and you reveal more and more, and you get subtleties of the character that are really, really charming, really fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, this film is called Larry, and Larry is 88 years old.
Okay.
He learned Photoshop at 70.
Yes.
He was a filmmaker. He did those Encyclopedia Britannica films for okay. schools.
Yeah.
And then eventually he went into narratives, and he did adaptations of classic novels like Faulkner and okay. others. And then he became a filmmaker and he did features. And at 70, he started doing street photographs, like long, he calls them photographic elevation. He removes the perspective and he does like architectural
oh, right.
landscapes. But 88, mm-hmm. and he's walking in the street with his camera, taking photos. I've got shots of him in the desert in Nevada, in the wind. Mm-hmm. And he goes back home and he's working with his cigar and his scotch. I want to be that guy.
Yeah.
That drive never dried out in that in that
awesome.
Man's life, you know?
Is that so, can people see that documentary?
I'm finishing it now.
Okay.
So I finished the cut last week. It's in post-production for sound, and I'm nitpicking on my grading right now.
Okay.
So we'll have a premiere in LA in spring.
Okay.
And then I'm going to put it on film festivals for a while and figure out what's
oh,
next.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
But each of them has been a journey of discovery, of just like sharing those moments with really fascinating people. And I'm lucky to be in the room with them, you know. And then when I cut that, I want the audience to be in the room with them.
Right.
You know? Trying to be as non-intrusive as possible. I avoid the eye contact. I really try to make it naturalistic. So that's where all the street photography comes in place.
Yeah.
It's seizing the moment. You know, you see him doing something and you're like, I know what you're going to do next. And you run to that location and you get the shot.
Right.
You know, so I do a lot of running.
Awesome. Awesome.
But,
well, we've gone well over an hour, believe it or not.
All right,
and this is, I think that's a good place to sort of wrap it up and talk about, you know, Larry's. Is that going to be the name of it? It's going to be called Larry. Great name.
Simple.
Simple name. So I can't wait to see Larry and available sometime in the spring. So we will keep people posted on this and let people know when it's available and when where to go see it, because that sounds awesome. Really great. And I loved your work. You know, when I saw it at THU, and I think you do fantastic work. We'll put links up. You've got a Vimeo page.
Okay.
Your Vimeo page is available.
I do,
so,
yeah.
So everyone can see some of your work there. Beautiful cinematography. Thanks. You film a lot of you do your own cinematography?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it shows. It's great. Thanks so much for sharing that and for sharing your story with people.
No, it's awesome. Thank you for having me here.
All right, thank you.
Bye.